This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Muselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the summer's really heating up, and things are also heating up around the Affordable Care Act as well.
Well, that's right, Mark. And the White House issued a bit of a bombshell recently when they announced that the implementation of the so-called employer mandate in the healthcare law is going to be delayed as long as 2015. And that was big news.
Well, administration officials say the delay is needed to ensure that the proper reporting infrastructure is in place. I think it's wise to wait and get it right, but it doesn't delay the start of the insurance exchanges, which seem to be on target for October.
And let's take a look at some of the statistics. Of more than 200,000 small businesses in the United States, only about 10,000 of them don't offer health insurance to their employees. And technically, these employees could enroll in the insurance exchange on their own, where they can get the tax subsidies and the premium discounts. So it's not like there's no options for those employees.
I think it's important, Margaret, that we continue to communicate with people about the Affordable Care Act and what it means to them. For instance, many folks don't know that in addition to tax subsidies to help defray the cost of purchasing insurance, there's also a cost-sharing provision for those gaining health coverage on the exchanges.
Because that really reduces the out-of-pocket expense in healthcare, which can be significant. So depending on income and what plan you purchase, you get additional assistance in meeting your true cost of health care with copays and the like.
There's also a great website where people can go for information at healthcare.gov.
Well, our guest today has spent a lot of time analyzing systems of care around the country and ways that that care can be improved. Dr. Ashish Jha is a practicing internist at the VA Boston Healthcare System and professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health.
He's got some interesting insights into the current state of healthcare in this country and how it can be improved in the future.
And factcheck.org's managing editor, Lori Robertson, looks at claims about federal employees' healthcare plans being impacted by the Affordable Care Act. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we'd love to hear from you.
Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Ashish Jha in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Obamacare and the employer mandate, the twain shall take more time to meet. In a stunning announcement before the July 4th holiday began, the Obama administration announced the so-called employer mandate would be postponed for a year to 2015. The provision in the Affordable Care Act that required companies with more than 50 employees to provide health coverage for their full-time staff or pay a penalty. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius saying there needs to be more infrastructure put in place to handle the law's verification technology. Nine pioneer ACOs, those newly formed accountable care organizations, are opting out of a program set up by the healthcare law, leaving instead for a more manageable Medicare alternative test of the payment model, the Shared Savings Program, which allows ACOs to opt for a payment arrangement that doesn't include the risk of financial losses. Scientists in Yokohama, Japan, are over the moon about something they've developed, growing a rudimentary liver in a petri dish. Scientists around the world are making some significant success growing less complex organs in the lab using foundational scaffolding for stem cells to grow on. The Japanese experiment decided to look at if harvesting the stem cells and programming them without scaffolding would yield the same results. Within 5 days, they'd grown a small, rudimentary but functioning liver, which they implanted in a mouse. While much refinement of the technique and promise for human trials is years away, these scientists say they were, quote, gobsmacked by their discovery. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Ashish Jha, practicing internist at the VA Boston Healthcare System and professor of health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health. For the past 5 years, Dr. Jha has served as special advisor for quality and safety to the Department of Veterans Affairs. He's a frequent contributor to Health Affairs, the Journal of American Medical Association, and is founder of his own blog, An Ounce of Evidence. He's the senior editor on a new health industry journal, Healthcare, the Journal of Delivery Science and Innovation. Dr. Jha is a senior research fellow at the West Health Policy Center, where his focus is on improving healthcare delivery and lowering cost. Dr. Jha received his medical degree from Harvard School of Medicine and his master's in public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be on.
We are so happy that you are with us. And you're a prolific observer of healthcare delivery and public policy in this country, but your particular focus is on gathering, sharing data that has the power to improve delivery of care. In fact, your blog, An Ounce of Evidence, is predicated on the idea that an ounce of evidence is worth 1,000 pounds of opinion. I love that. Your focus on the healthcare debate has been bringing data into the discussion. So maybe you can share with our listeners your vision about how technology and data can help us improve healthcare.
Sure. You know, the healthcare system obviously is extremely complex. And we often get into trouble because we have very simple answers to these very complex questions. Most of the times when I look at the complex problems that are facing our healthcare system around cost and quality, it's rare that I feel like I have the right solution. And I really think the solutions are out there, but technology, I think, will have a really important role to play. But how do we actually get technology to start helping us deliver better care at lower costs? And how do we actually get data to help us make better decisions? That's the challenge. And that's what I work on. If we can use these and other tools, I think we can really begin to have an impact that's sustainable over the long run.
Well, Dr. Jha, you have a unique perch, I think, by being at the VA, an example of a healthcare system that, you know, maybe was thought of as having some serious flaws in the past, but has really transformed itself into what is recognized as a very high quality system of care. And what you did was seem to marry up the use of technology and information with culture change to achieve some real breakthroughs in quality of care. Maybe you could share with our listeners, how did the VA do that? How did they use health data to achieve significant improvements in the quality of care and get people to change their behaviors along with it?
Yeah, really, for 60-some-odd years, it had a reputation for being an organization that, you know, that really did not deliver top-notch health care. And in the mid-1990s, under the Clinton administration, the VA put in a new healthcare leader, a guy named Ken Kaiser. And Ken was a former Navy SEAL. And when he came in, his task was really very simple, which was transform the healthcare system that delivers care to the VA, to veterans, in a way that really both improves outcomes, improves quality, and lowers costs. But what Ken Kaiser and the leadership of the organization did at the time was they took what I think of as a series of very free market principles. First and foremost, they said, look, it's too hard to make all the really important decisions in Washington, D.C. We think the key decisions about costs and quality and really should be done much more locally. But along with that came accountability. And so for accountability, they said, we need data. And so they started collecting data nationally on a series of quality metrics and said, we have to hit these benchmarks. And holding government employees accountable for metrics, not always the easiest thing. And then during this entire time period, put in an electronic health record across the country. I think the combination of accountability, incentives, all of this stuff was publicly reported to Congress and other key stakeholders, and IT. The combination of all of that stuff really transformed the organization in a few short years. And what it has taught me is that it's unlikely that any one thing could have done it. If they had just put in technology, I doubt it would have done very much. If they had just had accountability and incentives, probably wouldn't have worked. It's really putting them all together with the right mix that had such a big impact on the VA healthcare system.
You know, let's talk a little bit about some of the data you've been examining. In particular, you've been writing about the Oregon experiment, which basically had a statewide lottery that allowed the uninsured to gain coverage to Medicaid. And it was written that after a number of years, the data suggested that patients didn't really fare much better in terms of things like management of cardiovascular disease or type 2 diabetes. But you say the data was misunderstood and that there were many aspects of the Oregon experiment that really did work. Help us better understand what the real story is there.
I think there are two or three lessons from Oregon that I think are unmistakable. So the first thing that I learned from the Oregon experiment is that health insurance works. Insurance is meant to be something that protects you from financial catastrophe. You know, we have insurance on our house. because if my house burnt down tomorrow, it would be a financial disaster for me, unless I have homeowner's insurance. In the same way, if I got sick tomorrow and I did not have health insurance, it could potentially bankrupt me. And what we saw in the Oregon experiment was that people who went on Medicaid, you know, they were far less likely to go bankrupt because of healthcare issues. And so from an insurance point of view, given what insurance is supposed to do, it really does work. And so for people who try to make the argument that insurance doesn't matter, I think the Oregon experiment has really put that to rest. So that's the side that the Democrats love and the people on the left love. Let's flip to the other side, which has been the issue around, well, does insurance improve health outcomes? And I personally think that's a very tall order to expect that health insurance alone will improve the health of the population. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, insurance gives you better access to doctors and nurses and hospitals. But to actually improve health, that health care that you get now has to be of really, really high quality. And our healthcare system fails to deliver high quality health care in any consistent fashion. And so what we see in the Oregon experiment is patients went to the doctor many, many times, and yet they still had really high blood pressure. They still had really poorly controlled diabetes. And that's not an indictment of insurance or Medicaid. It's an indictment of our healthcare system and that it's unable to really deliver on effective chronic disease management. And so I basically have made the argument, let's not oversell the value of health insurance. Very important for bankruptcy protection, very important for its financial protections. But from a health outcomes point of view, it's necessary, but it is not sufficient. We're really going to have to improve the healthcare delivery system if we want it to actually improve patient outcomes.
Well, Ashish, we've talked a little bit about Oregon on the West Coast, but let's bring it east, where you are in Massachusetts. Certainly the focus of a lot of study and interest since the passage of landmark reform in 2006, and there's both legislation and action on the ground to control costs. But in that middle, in that experience of what did happen in terms of health from either a utilization or a outcome point of view. And I wonder if you'd like to comment, being right there in Massachusetts, what data do we have on any measurable changes in the health of the population?
It's a really good question. And, you know, what Massachusetts, again, has taught us is not unlike what Oregon is teaching us, which is when you give people insurance, it does have huge financial benefits and financial protections for people. You know, what we saw is in the early days, people were hoping for some substantial decline in utilization. We really didn't see that. 4 or 5 years in, actually in the first couple of years, we saw an increase in ER use. That stabilized and has come down. And now I think in some ways we're back to baseline. There are some preliminary studies that I've seen that suggest that for people who are uninsured, getting health insurance really did make a big difference in their health. And, you know, in the last 5 years, healthcare costs in Massachusetts have continued to rise at a pretty fast clip. So if you take a step back and say, what has Massachusetts taught us? I would say two or three things. One is it's certainly possible to get to universal access without any major, you know, disruptions of the healthcare system. Second, work that we have done says, you know, asks the question, when you give a whole bunch of people health insurance, do you make things much worse off for everyone else because you're flooding the system with new people? And it turns out from the work that we've done and other people have done, the answer is not really. The capacity of the healthcare system to absorb new patients is pretty amazing, and the system is resilient. But don't expect, again, insurance alone to do much for you on either cost or on patient outcomes. And that's the part that we really need to work on. We need to figure out how to make the healthcare delivery system work better in terms of quality and as well as efficiency.
We're speaking today with Dr. Ashish Jha, practicing internist at the VA Boston Healthcare System and professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health. And for the past 5 years, Dr. Jha has served as special advisor for quality and safety to the Department of Veterans Affairs. Dr. Jha writes extensively for numerous medical journals, including his own blog, An Ounce of Evidence, and is senior editor at the new health industry journal, Healthcare, the Journal of Delivery Science and Innovation. Ashish, tell us a little more about the work that you're doing with this new journal, and tell us a little bit of why you decided to go forward with this, and who are some of the contributing editors to it, and what do you hope the impact will be?
So, you know, when we first started talking about this, and really the driving force behind the new journal are these two young folks, Sachin Jain and Amol Nawati, who are both physicians at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And when they first sort of came to me with this idea, and you know, the first question I asked myself and other people have asked is, do we really need yet one more healthcare journal? And I think we pretty quickly concluded as we looked at the landscape that the answer was yes, for the following reasons. There are very few, really arguably no other journals that we could identify that were focused on the science of healthcare delivery. There are lots of terrific journals out there. One of my favorites is Health Affairs, very focused on healthcare policy, very focused on kind of how do things that we do in Washington or in state capitals really impact healthcare delivery. But if you're the leader of a healthcare system, and you're trying to think about, well, how do I actually make improvements in, let's say, infection rates across my hospitals? There are surprisingly few places where you can turn to get rigorous, thoughtfully described, data-driven recommendations. And that's the niche that we thought was really important to begin to attack. How do we help clinical leaders and organizational leaders and policymakers think about improving the healthcare delivery system? And so our first issue is out. We had two terrific people, Melinda Bunton and Rachel Warner. Melinda is at the Congressional Budget Office, soon heading off to Vanderbilt, and Rachel Warner is at the University of Pennsylvania. They edited the first issue. It was about payment innovation and how can new payment models really help improve healthcare delivery. We're going to have issues on quality improvement, on health information technology, patient-centered innovation. These are some of the themes, and again, we're going to have a lot of very good people who are going to be leading the efforts. But as we publish stuff and as we get stuff out, we'll get feedback from the marketplace about what kinds of things are getting traction and are useful, what kinds of things are really redundant with other things that are out there. And I'm confident we'll make changes along the way. But that's the vision right now, is that there is this important gap to fill, and we want to play a helpful role in that area.
Ashish, you're currently a research fellow as well at the West Health Policy Center, whose stated goal is to greatly reduce costs in healthcare while at the same time improving quality and outcomes. And in fact, we've had your colleague on the show, West Health's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Joseph Smith, who spoke about that mission very eloquently. Maybe you could share with us what specific area of cost containment are you focusing on in your work at the West Health Institute?
Yeah, you know, I obviously can't do the West Health Institute the kind of justice that Joe can. He really is the intellectual and I think the sort of passionate leader behind it. I'll describe our project, and we actually just published a paper on this 3 days ago in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association. But here's the notion. So when I'm speaking to audiences about healthcare spending, I mentioned that, you know, 10% of Medicare beneficiaries account for about 60-70% of all the healthcare spending. And everybody knows this, and everybody kind of nods. And so we know that healthcare spending is very concentrated. A small number of people really account for most of the spending. The second thing we know is that people who tend to be these high-cost patients, they tend to have more chronic illnesses, they tend to be sicker, they tend to be older. Well, you'd say, of course they are. I mean, completely not surprising that people who are older and sicker are going to end up using more healthcare resources. That makes total sense. The logical leap that people make next is they assume that most of that spending among these high-cost patients is for their chronic illnesses. It's for their diabetes. It's for their hypertension. It's for their heart failure. And so that's the question that we thought was really important. Is it the chronic illness that's driving most of the spending? What exactly is it? And so that was the project that West supported. And we just finished and we published our first paper on this. We have a lot more work to do, but I'll give you the highlights. What we found basically was among high-cost patients, you know, most of their spending is in hospital care. And then we said, what proportion of that hospital care is really preventable? And we use AHRQ has a definition of preventable hospitalizations. And we found that only 9.5% of the total inpatient spending for these high-cost patients were these preventable things. So that's really interesting, and I think it surprised a lot of us.
Yeah.
What it told us, they're expensive because they get major procedures. They get defibrillators. They get hip replacements. Mm-hmm. They go to the hospital and then end up getting sepsis and end up being in the ICU for 4 weeks. These very, very expensive episodes, that's what drives the other 90%. And things like chronic disease management, nurse manager, sort of better care coordination, very, very important, but it isn't going to get us nearly far enough. It's not going to save us the kind of money that we would ideally like. We're going to have very different strategies for saving money on these very expensive patients.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Ashish Jha, internist at VA's Boston Healthcare System and professor of health policy at Harvard School of Public Health. You can follow his writings at his blog site, An Ounce of Evidence, and follow him on Twitter. Ashish, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, this week we'll talk about a Democratic talking point about Republicans in Congress who want to repeal the Affordable Care Act. The line is that these Republicans were, quote, voting Congress taxpayer-funded health care for life. But the truth is no one has voted to give Congress health insurance that they don't already have. Here's where this distorted talking point comes from. Members of Congress have long received health insurance through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, which, much like the soon-to-be-launched healthcare exchanges, offers a choice of private health plans. 8 million federal employees and retirees get their health insurance this way. But a Republican amendment to the Affordable Care Act requires members of Congress and their staff to get insurance through the exchanges instead. If the law were to be repealed, Congress would simply go back to getting health insurance the same way they had been. The federal plan is generous. The government pays an average of 72% of the cost of premiums, just as most work-based coverage is largely paid by the employer. We recently saw this claim in an ad from a Democratic Political Action Committee attacking Republican Representative Tom Cotton, a potential Senate candidate in Arkansas. But Cotton didn't vote for some new taxpayer-funded health care for himself and other lawmakers for life. Instead, he voted to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Right now, there are about 3.5 million people living in refugee camps around the world. Whether displaced by wars or natural disasters, the plight of these people is often the same, living in squalid conditions in tent cities that provide little protection from harsh elements. And these conditions pose serious threats to their health and well-being. The IKEA Foundation has taken the parent company's wildly successful do-it-yourself approach to home furnishings and applied it to the problem of inadequate housing for displaced refugees. They've created a do-it-yourself dwelling that can be shipped and assembled anywhere.
So first and foremost, there's the very well-known flat pack approach that IKEA has pioneered. Secondly, the materials and the product itself. So it's a shelter. It's not a tent.
Jonathan Spampinato is the head of communications and strategic planning at the IKEA Foundation. They're working closely with United Nations organizations working on the ground, trying to assist refugees in Somalia and other parts of the world.
We extended that to also include funding for an innovation unit within the UNHCR so they could think more long term. So providing that funding allowed them to start the refugee housing shelter, looking at how to design a better shelter.
And since on average a person is likely to spend up to 12 years in a refugee camp, these IKEA structures have some unique properties that can make the experience more bearable.
The walls and the roof are made out of a new fancy version of basically a plastic material that is much more durable but very, very lightweight and still is insulated.
The IKEA Foundation currently has prototypes being tested in various refugee camps and will scale up production once refinements are made. And, true to IKEA, The price point is going to come in under $1,000 per structure. A deliverable, affordable, do-it-yourself dwelling that can provide some sense of dignity, privacy, and protection for families who are struggling as refugees. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.